This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area, Monday, May 7th, 2012. A bill to allow civil unions in Colorado is poised for a showdown in the Republican-controlled House on the final days of the state's legislative session. The measure narrowly cleared two Republican House committees by one vote, but still faces one more committee hearing before it can head to the full floor for debate. Benta Berkland discusses the politics behind the measure as part of our Capital Conversation series.
I'm here with Lynn Bartles with the Denver Post and Patrick Malone with the Pueblo Chieftain. Lynn, talk about the two Republican lawmakers who bucked GOP House leadership to vote for this bill. Neither one is seeking re-election.
But both of them said that even if they were, they still would vote for the bill. Representative B.J. Nichol is of Loveland. She voted against the bill last year, but she said in thinking about it, she realized it was time to do it. She was actually one of the people considered a swing vote last year. Also, Representative Don Beasley of Broomfield voted for the bill in the Finance Committee, and he has chosen not to run for re-election. He's known as quite a libertarian, and I don't think his vote surprised a lot of people.
And Patrick, what do you think this means for the party? We're seeing a lot more division among the GOP on this issue than we have in the past.
It's hard to say whether it's division or evolution, because you talk to young Republicans and they tend to lean more towards this libertarian, rugged individualism ideal rather than the conformity of lockstep social conservatism. I look at someone like Troy Ard, who's active college Republican from Pueblo, testified at one of the civil unions hearings, and he's as staunch a conservative as you'll find among the 20-somethings, but there are kids his age who are the future of the Republican Party, and the question is going to be, do they conform to the traditional ideals of the Republican Party, or does the Republican Party grow with them?
Lynn, I want to talk about the final few days of the session. This bill still needs to pass the Appropriations Committee. The sponsor said that committee typically meets Tuesday morning, and then it would need to initially pass the House on Tuesday and then have a final vote on Wednesday. So there's still quite a few steps in the process. What can we expect?
Well, we know that if it gets out of the Appropriations Committee in time to be heard on the floor Tuesday, it's over, it's passed, it's done. Because there are 33 Republicans and 32 Democrats. All they need is one Republican, and they already have a handful. I think the last challenge will be a big challenge for them. It's the final hurdle. I think there's going to be jockeying up the yin-yang over the weekend on both sides to encourage people to vote one way or the other.
Patrick, we've heard the governor speak very forcefully on this issue. He mentioned it during his State of the State address. He's recently pushed for it again. Like Lynn was mentioning, there's still a lot of bills in play. What kind of position does this put House leadership in? The top members of the House don't support this bill.
House leadership is at the true crossroads. They're the ones who could really sit on this thing and do some political maneuvering that could keep it from passing. And in fact, if it gets through that committee on Tuesday, that's about the only thing that can really stop it. But they have a really hard decision to make. They really aren't losing anything with the votes that have been in favor of this bill from Republicans. Like Lynn has mentioned, these are folks who are not seeking re-election. But this will be a record against the caucus as a whole if its leaders hold this back and don't let the elected representatives decide the fate of this bill.
I think it's worth noting for listeners, when a bill passes a committee, it's the discretion of leadership when that bill goes to the full House floor for a vote. Weeks can pass, days can pass. There's a lot of things that impact when the vote will go to the full chamber floor. In this case, you know, time's running out, so they'd have to move it immediately. Lynn, do you agree that it's a tough spot for them?
It is a tough spot for them, and I know Republicans are actually really upset that Democrats waited so long to pass this bill out of the Senate, putting it at the end. It's this shoot now with an explosion of things going on, vetoes, high-profile bills, now the civil unions. And the last few days have been more frantic than they have been at this place in a long time, I think.
Thanks. That was Lynn Bartles with the Denver Post and Patrick Malone with the Pueblo Chieftain. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver, and you've been listening to Capital Conversation.
Capital coverage from Rocky Mountain Community Radio is supported by Colorado River District, celebrating its 75th year of protecting western Colorado water and reminding all that in this historic year of low snowpack, protecting and conserving water is more important than ever. More at coloradoriverdistrict.org.
On Friday, the Bureau of Land Management released a draft rule requiring companies to publicly disclose the chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing operations on public and Indian lands. The rule is very similar to the Colorado rule that went into effect in April. According to the Interior Department, there is currently no specific requirement for operators to disclose these chemicals on federal and Indian lands, where approximately 90% of the wells drilled use hydraulic fracturing. Current BLM regulations governing hydraulic fracturing operations on public lands are more than 30 years old and were not written to address modern hydraulic fracturing activities. The proposed rule would require public disclosure of chemicals used during hydraulic fracturing after those operations have been completed. The agency hopes to post that information on a public website, possibly the existing website known as fracfocus.org. The rule also deals with improving wellbore integrity and water management plans for fracturing fluids that flow back to the surface. In a statement, Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar said the rule is in support of President Obama's all-of-the-above energy strategy and the administration's goal of continuing to expand responsible oil and gas production. During the first 3 years of the Obama administration, federal oil production has increased by 13%, and total natural gas production from onshore public lands has increased by 6%. The rules include chemical disclosure regulations similar to those developed and implemented in Colorado. On Friday, Governor John Hickenlooper released a statement saying he was, quote, pleased that the BLM modeled its disclosure requirements for fracturing fluids after the Colorado rule, which is the most protective and transparent in the country, end quote. And like the Colorado rule, the BLM rule would still allow for some proprietary information, so-called trade secrets, to be exempt from disclosure. The federal rules affect activity on BLM lands, but the Colorado regulations still apply. Jim Ramey, director of Citizens for a Healthy Community, says that the BLM rule seems to have the same problems as the Colorado rule. He criticizes the rule for still allowing for trade secret exemptions and only requiring operators to disclose the fracking fluid ingredients after the wells are drilled. Ramey told KVNF, quote, how is the public supposed to know what's going on if they don't disclose until after they drill a well? It's too little, too late, end quote. Once the proposed rule is published in the Federal Register, a 60-day public comment period will begin, during which the public, governments, industry, and other stakeholders are encouraged to provide their input. Victims of the deadly Lower North Fork fire south of Denver may be getting more compensation from the state than the current law allows. The governor, attorney general, and legislative leaders from both parties have brokered a compromise on the issue that became heated in the final days of the legislative session. Ben DeBerkland has more for us from the state capitol.
Colorado's Governmental Immunity Act caps payments at $600,000 for all claims for an incident. Governor John Hickenlooper says under the new proposal, victims of the North Fork fire could ask the state claims board for additional money beyond that cap. They would first have to prove the state acted negligently. The claims board could then make a recommendation to the state legislature for more money.
There's nothing that's going to get done in this building that is going to be totally replace what they've lost. But I think from a moral perspective, this allows the victims to have an opportunity to really work within the system.
What began as a state-controlled burn aimed at preventing wildfires killed three people and destroyed 27 homes. Republican Attorney General John Southers says future victims of state-controlled burns could also seek a waiver.
The Colorado Constitution doesn't allow us to take a group of already identified citizens and treat them differently than the rest of the population.
A separate Republican bill is already moving through the legislature. It would create a state commission to process claims and pay victims. And while the plan has bipartisan support, the governor and attorney general both said it wasn't well thought out and was unfair to other victims of state negligence. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Governor John Hickenlooper used his veto pen for the first time this year on a bill to expand an incentive program for tourism projects across the state. He says the Republican bill tried to do too much too fast. Here's Benta Berkland again with more for us from the state capitol.
Senate Bill 124 would have allowed state funding for six major tourism projects in 1 year. The current law on the books caps it at two projects per year and up to $50 million of funding annually. Governor John Hickenlooper says it's better to take it slow and make certain those tax dollars are spent wisely.
It dramatically increases the potential for mistakes. If you rush into it, you know, it makes my body tense up, right? The thought of just doing too much too fast. It's a recipe for regret.
Hickenlooper also says he wants to make sure the tourism projects are designed to bring in money from out-of-state visitors and not simply shuffle around money that would already be spent in Colorado. But Republicans criticized the governor for the veto, saying the legislation was a grassroots effort to improve economic development. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
And in other news from the state capitol, a bill to create a legal standard for driving while high passed the House Judiciary Committee on Thursday after a lengthy hearing. The bill next heads to the House Appropriations Committee. In addition, a bill that would encourage third graders who can't read to repeat the grade has unanimously passed in the state Senate. Democrats made several changes to the bill, including giving school districts money to help young students that are falling behind. You're about to meet some cute little kids with tiny teeth in the dental clinic at Children's Hospital of Colorado in Denver. It might seem strange, but health experts are recommending parents take their babies to the dentist really early to stave off years of cavities and painful dental work. That's because more and more preschoolers are ending up with a mouthful of decay. From Colorado Public News, Carol McKinley reports.
It may not sound like it, but 2-year-old Reese Burke is not hurt. She's just upset because she doesn't want her teeth cleaned. Pediatric dental hygienist Valerie Hostein is doing her best to distract Reese by wearing a Groucho Marx-like mask and scrubbing her teeth with a Tigger toothbrush.
I see pretty princess teeth. Oh, they're so nice. Oh, they're so good.
But I always tell moms that, you know, if they're crying and fighting and fussing with you when you're brushing their teeth, this is a fight you have to win.
Hostein works at Children's Hospital's very busy dental clinic where the waiting room is buzzing. Children are playing with toys and watching cartoons as frazzled parents try to keep them still. The clinic here partners with a Colorado state initiative called Cavity Free at 3. It's a program with a lofty goal: to eliminate tooth decay for toddlers, in part by encouraging parents to get babies in for their first dental visit much earlier than you might think.
So we have started recommending by age 1, or by the eruption of their first tooth, which can sometimes be even earlier than age 1.
They have teeth, they can have dental problems.
Pediatric dentist Dr. Mark Cook says that in his 30 years of practice, he's never seen so many kids with so many cavities. He's looking at a dental chart which shows a row of decayed baby teeth.
You see these back-to-back areas here, here, tooth. It might be brownish, it might be grayish, it might be black.
National studies show tooth decay has reached epidemic proportions for American preschoolers, and it has become our number one pediatric chronic health disease.
I think a lot of that is because many young parents today are perhaps unaware of what dental decay looks like and don't get it treated until it's reached a state that is in really bad shape.
Colorado's latest health report card shows too many of our kids are not seeing a dentist. Nearly a third of them had no checkup last year, which ranked Colorado 38th compared to other states. Hostein says failure to catch cavities early on can end up being excruciatingly painful in the long run and expensive.
What started out as a $40 tooth filling or a cavity that could have been prevented entirely may turn into over, a $2,000 or $3,000 investment.
No, my ABCs. Next time.
Hostein is singing to Reese to keep the child's mind off of the fact that her baby teeth are getting painted with a fluoride solution. Reese is on her back with her head in Hostein's lap and her mom, Jessica, on the other end holding her legs. Jessica confesses she hates going to the dentist, but she's making dental health a priority for her seven kids, whether they like it or not.
I'm the mean mom, so they don't. I say brushing is number one out the door in the morning.
You're so clean.
You know,
Reese's day isn't so bad after all. She ends up in her mom's arms, running her finger along a new shiny smile.
So nice. Okay, all done. Give your mom a big hug. Give your mom a big hug. Thanks for taking care of my teeth, Mom.
Pediatric dental health professionals recommend that parents find a family dentist they can rely on and limit sugary beverages. Also, they should wash or brush their kids' teeth twice a day, put only tap water in that sippy cup, and maybe invest in some earplugs. Carol McKinley, Colorado Public News.
For our final story this morning, a bank robbery at the Wells Fargo Bank in Carbondale at closing time Saturday was the third robbery in the Roaring Fork Valley in as many months. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel is reporting the incident, which occurred just before 4 p.m. Saturday, is being investigated by Carbondale Police and the FBI. Police said a male suspect entered the bank, used a handgun to threaten five employees and a customer, and bound their hands behind their backs before fleeing. No one was injured in the incident, and Carbondale Police Chief Gene Schilling said he couldn't release whether the suspect escaped with any cash. A Vectra Bank branch was robbed in Elgibel on March 2nd when a robber with his face shrouded in a ski hat and wearing ski gloves demanded cash and escaped with an undisclosed amount. And on April 27th, police responded to a robbery at the U.S. Bank in Glenwood Springs. That suspect handed tellers a note demanding cash. Witnesses told police the note indicated the man had a gun, but a gun was not displayed. This concludes this morning's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria. Good day.